So, friends, what we've seen from the excerpt we just considered from Krishna is the definition of a life meditation, meditation of a lifetime, the constant focus, the point on which the entire lifetime of a man may be spent in its essence. This William Kujach calls one's life's meditation. Now, what is this life's meditation? If you were to look at it from a psychological perspective, they call it the narrative identity. Now, a narrative identity is essentially a story that we all author and weave for ourselves based on a kind of autobiographical memory of the events that have happened to us. The story is usually integral, meaning it takes disparate life events and integrates them into a seeming whole. You're not the person you were when you were a child. You're not the person now when you were the same as when you were a teenager, and so on and so forth. But yet, there is an integration of all of those phases of your life and all of the disparate events into the story that you call your life story. It is an identity derived from the narrative that you've constructed for yourself. In it, of course, you are the main protagonist. No, that is not to say that this story is essentially solipsism, meaning it is not that you are simply consumed in your own little story. Our stories abut other stories around which we participate in society. Those closest to us, we share our stories with them. They integrate and plug into our stories at various points. They also frame and provide a reference. You can think of it as a nesting of our story in a larger story or adjacent stories. Our stories may have chapters and paragraphs, but there is a, you can think of it as a superordinate arc of the story. It moves in a certain direction. Now, what does the story provide us? Why do we construct these stories? Well, this story, this life story, this narrative identity, it is literally what gives this lower personality, the talking, sensing, acting personality, a sense of unity. You have integrated all of these disparate events, disparate drives that you may have into this narrative. And so it gives you a sense of unity, you being this one individual, even though you're not even close to the person you were when you were a child. It gives a sense of agency. Now, this is very important. This narrative has in it many points in the past where you would have made certain choices in life. Now, when you think about those choices in this narrative, you would have rationalized those choices. At the point of making those choices, what led you to make the choice, you have literally forgotten. There is a lot of sociological experiments that have shown this to be true. I'll give you one such experiment. So it turns out, human beings in general are right-handed. And for that reason, our brains are evolved in such a way that we have a preference to what's at the rightmost end of a set of choices physically. That much is given even from a neurological perspective, that's been proven. So the experiment that they ran was something like Christmas night or in the morning, you come back down and there is a set of stockings that is hung up on a fireplace. The stockings are identical. There is absolutely no difference between them. The objects that are placed, the gifts from Santa that are placed in them are also the same. And subjects are brought before these set of stockings and they're asked to pick a stocking. Now we know neurologically that there is a preference to pick the rightmost stocking. And not surprisingly, most participants picked something in the right-hand side, the rightmost stockings. They picked it, they looked at their gift, they were happy with it. And then they were asked, why did you pick that stocking? Everybody had a special story for why they picked that stocking. They would say it was a very bright stocking. It was the brightest of the lot. It hung over a part of the fireplace that had, you know, more warmth, whatever it may be, all of which were false from an actual data perspective. But having made a choice, you have rationalized it in some way. You have incorporated that into a story and you have assumed in that story that you had agency. You had full free will in making that decision. Although we know your brain is wired to pick something from the right side. So you literally didn't have much free will in that choice. You were just through biology driven to make certain choices. So this narrative identity gives you a sense of what they call post hoc, meaning after the event, rationalized agency. It of course gives you orientation. How do you orient yourself in life? You have to have some backing story. And the storyline is proceeding in a certain direction. And that direction, when you extrapolate, gives you directionality. You know this is the tending direction in which your life is going. And you've identified yourself with that story and you're the protagonist, and that is the orientation that you have. It has an orienting sense. And if at the very ultimate end of that extrapolation of the storyline, you find purpose. Say, the end of what I'm trying to do in my life is that purpose. And meaning making. There are so many things that happen to us that may seem very random. If you don't believe in the doctrines of karma, as most people don't or have a misunderstanding of it, they may seem like random events that are happening and you're the victim of circumstances. But if you have a narrative, you can plug these into the narrative and post hoc make rationalizations of all of those circumstances and make meaning out of what may seem otherwise to be meaningless set of random events. So the storyline that you tell yourself, that you construct for yourself, and you tell other people when you meet them, is important. And we exude that storyline in various ways. You may not completely tell your story to somebody else, but just from the way you dress, the way you talk, what subjects you choose, how you interact with people, you're sending social cues as to what your story is, and others are sending you social cues, and you're adjusting your story, you're negotiating the story, and you're letting it flow as it goes. Now, these stories are not just individual stories. Like we said, your story integrates with and is buffeted by the stories of those around you and that of the community to which you belong, and then the state and the nation. So there is a kind of nesting of your story in other stories. And what you find when you look at ancient stories is that in that storytelling, the ancients picked out certain values that they were able to then exalt at the community level. So for example, let's take this very simple story that everybody's probably heard of Theseus and Minotaur. So it's a Greek story where the king of Crete or Crete city, his name is Minos. He is gifted, this backing story for this is irrelevant, but he gets a gift from the gods of a beautiful white ox. Poseidon, I think, one of the Greek gods, asks for that ox to be sacrificed to him. And Minos, in his arrogance, will say, no, no, this ox is too beautiful for me. I will not be sacrificing it to you. And Poseidon curses him, his wife rather, to fall in love with that ox. His wife falls in love with the ox, and in that union has a child who is Minotaur, whose head is that of an ox and body of a man, and is a fierce creature who's carnivorous and actually feeds on humans. That's his diet. Minos, to keep the shame hidden, has his best artisans create a maze, which is called the Labyrinth, which is so intricate that he places Minotaur in the middle so that he cannot escape. But to feed him, Minos says he would have earlier conquered Athens and subjugated them. And as tribute, he would say, every year, send me 7 young men and 7 young women to be sent into the labyrinth for Minotaur to eat them. So Athens complies with that agreement for 2 years. On the 3rd year, the prince of Athens, whose name is Theseus, he volunteers to go as one of the young men. And he goes to Crete, I think, in ancient Greece. And Minos' daughter, whose name is Ariadne, falls in love with Theseus and gives him a sword with which he can slay Minotaur and a ball of thread. So Theseus, as he goes into the labyrinth, lays the thread along, goes, slays Minotaur, and using Ariadne's thread, finds his way out of the labyrinth. HBB references the thread of Ariadne as the thread of truth in many places, and this is the story behind that. Now, when you hear the story, the Greeks derived from it what they valued. So apparently, the Greeks valued individual above the state. They felt the state was there to support the individual, right? And hence, what they saw from the story and derived from the story was the bravery of Theseus, the love of Ariadne, the power and the chivalry which he slays, or the martial spirit with which he slays Minotaur, and so on and so forth. All of the exemplary characteristics of Theseus is what they took away from the story when they told everybody. As it so happens, Greeks saw the Romans as somewhat lesser than themselves. Romans were somewhat, less sophisticated, less advanced from their perspective. But so happens, Romans, actually vanquished the Greeks and took over their lands and, of course, built the Greco-Roman culture that we all now know. They took over some of the Greek stories and retold them. And apparently the Romans valued the state above the individual. They said the individual sacrifices to the state and state is paramount. And so from the same story in the Greek retelling, what you find is the storytellers appreciating Theseus's sacrifice for Athens. He says, I won't send my 7 young men. I will go in their regard, in their stead. And so they derive certain other values from the same story. So what we learn from this is, stories have many facets to them. And depending on what values you already possess in a way, you derive those and accentuate and exemplify them. Right? Now, these stories have power, huge power. And we'll take a few contemporary examples to illustrate it. When the student was thinking about this title, the one story or historical event that really stood out, very poignant event, but we should consider it, was the Jonestown Massacre, which happened, I think, in 1977, 78. So this was in the US. There was this guy, his name was Jim Jones. He had some kind of messianic inclinations. He hated capitalism. He said he was anti-capitalist. He said this entire society is debased. Capitalism is predatory. He had Marxist ideologies. He even had something called apostolic socialism, is kind of how we thought about it. He was very much in love with Russia, or back then the socialist regime there. And he found a bunch of followers. He told a very compelling story. And it's not a story that we would not find compelling even today. I mean, you do find that capitalism is predatory to a large extent. There is crony capitalism. There is a widening gap in wealth and inequality. But these facts were woven by this person into his narrative, which he called apostolic socialism. And it was so compelling that he had a lot of following. His ideas were so radical, he had to eventually go find a place in the Caribbean island to fully expound his rather radical ideas. And so they went to this place where they founded this thing called the Jonestown, where they imported a lot of these people. And they had this ritual where every day or every week or whatever it is, in some periodic time, everyone will commune, and there would be this large pot of Kool-Aid that everybody would drink from. And then he had this idea of, if we cannot fight capitalism, we will die, as in commit suicide, as a protest against capitalism. And his idea was, at some point, this bowl of Kool-Aid will be poisoned, and everybody will drink willingly of it and commit suicide in protest against capitalism and die. It's like a mass murder suicide. And that actually happened. The cultural shock from that, I think we still use the idiom drinking the Kool-Aid to mean unquestioningly taking somebody's story narrative and internalizing it and acting according to it. 909, something like that, people died in one day in that mass suicide event. Apparently, some people were also killed against their will. We don't know the exact details. But many of them, there were two eyewitnesses that said that many of them voluntarily drank of it. Mothers gave the poison Kool-Aid to their children before drinking it themselves. The power of this story was so profound that it overran even the most base instinct of survival in these people, and motherly instincts. That's the power of storytelling, right? It was apparently the second largest civilian casualties in one event in the US. And of course, the largest event with the highest number of civilian casualties in the US was 9/11. We are on the 24th anniversary this week of that event where 3,000 people died. Again, driven by a certain jihadi narrative. The hijackers came from well-to-do families. They were engineers and doctors. They came from not impoverished countries. They came from Saudi Arabia and UAE. And they had literally no political grievances. But they had bought into this narrative, this storyline that drove them to fly planes into buildings. So it's, storytelling is very powerful, very powerful. Now, we have seen the community level impact of certain stories and certain narratives. Is it individually consequential is the question. Now, there is no better novel to explore this than Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. It was his last novel and perhaps the novel in which he fully expounded his philosophy, existential philosophy. In that story, there is this father who's Fyodor Karamazov. He has three sons from, I think, two wives. And each son has an internal story of his own. He has a narrative arc of his own. And then we see the consequences of what happens to each of those three sons. The eldest son, his name is Dmitry, he is a sensualist. He's like Epicurus. He believes only in sense enjoyments. The middle guy, his name is Ivan, he has, like majority of the people in the West and with a Western outlook, is a rationalist and a nihilist, right? He has a kind of a nihilistic attitude. And it's all based on rational inquiry, empiricism, things like that. And then he famously says, and this line is very famous in the book, he claims there is no God, and he says, if there is no God, everything is lawful. Lawful. Everything is allowed. There is nothing prohibited. Because in his mind, there must be something that grounds all morality. And in his conception, that was God. In the absence of that, everything is lawful, everything is allowed, right? That was his, the famous line in the book is, if there is no God, everything is lawful. That's his story. And the protagonist of the story, who is the youngest brother, his name is Alyosha, whose philosophy in life is universal love and forgiveness. So essentially, Christ-like. His Christianity was Christ-like Christianity. So what happens in the storyline to all three? Well, Dmitry pursues the same woman his father is in love with, is in entanglements, wants to kill his father, gets into all kinds of legal trouble, eventually gets arrested. Even though he didn't kill him, he's falsely accused and he's in prison. Ivan goes mad, literally goes mad. Because this kind of empirical, rationalist nihilism has no eventual end. You're kind of going around in circles. He talks to his younger brother. His younger brother, offers him the ideas of this Christ-like Christianity, which he rejects. But he's torn internally. And he's so conflicted that he eventually ends up in madness. And Alyosha alone goes on to basically, he imbibes the full teachings of his mentor, Zosima, I don't know how it's pronounced, Father Zosima. Zosima, I think, with a Z. And goes on to live a spiritually awakened life. So essentially what Dostoevsky is saying is the narrative identity, the story that each of these three brothers were telling themselves, the philosophy of life that they approached their individual choices with, shaped their life in extremely different ways. So it is individually consequential. And this was recognized by Plato. So in Republic Book 3, he literally says, he chides, in fact, I think, through the dialogue of other, of course, his interlocutors, to say that the poets, the ancient Greek poets, such as Homer, exactly. Homer, we would think, is an amazing poet. He chides him to say he's creating stories that portray gods as with evil characteristics, as having vices. And when you keep giving out stories like this that become very popular, people imbibe from those stories such vices. They assume that if the gods behave this way, it is acceptable. You imbibe those verities, quote unquote, into yourself and enact that way. And so he said, in the perfect republic, stories must be censored. There should only be stories that are told that have the highest virtue, because it influences the society. Stories drive societal impact. Now, why is that? Why are stories so enticing? Well, if you've gone through any highly emotional Bollywood movie, you've gone through the roller coaster of emotions as you go through the story, it's that when you are reading a story, you have suspended disbelief. You've identified yourself with the protagonist, and you're experiencing at a feelings level, viscerally, all the emotions and the choices that the protagonist is going through. Now, if you think about action, right, how action proceeds out of us, the ultimate instrument of action is, of course, the panchakarmendriyas, the five organs of action. But the one penultimate principle through which all actions have to filter is that feeling, that emotion, that desire, which is why we have this famous saying that behind will stands desire. You have to evoke that emotion, that feeling, and through that act. And when you go through a story through a protagonist's viewpoint and his emotions, you're in a way like an AI training model, training that part of your principle to imbibe those choices, those values, those virtues or vices. And as you train that principle, so it acts. This is why, going back to what Krishna said, life's meditation, that in on which you preponderatingly think, in that likeness, your lower swabhavas learn and shape themselves, and your actions proceed from that. And this is why Aristotle, in his work, Nicomachean Ethics, describes what ethics are as habituated virtues. Ethics aren't abstract ideas of what is virtuous and what is not. It is taking those virtues and habituating them in a way, as an AI model, training it into it so that that's how it behaves. Imbibed. It behaves that way without inhibitions, without, we all actually have an incorrect view of this, which goes back to the post hoc rationalization. We rationalize back onto our choices and we say, I rationally thought about all the decisions, I weighed them in some way, and this is why I made those choices. But in reality, at the point of choice, your swabhavas are simply expressing themselves. So you have to habituate the ethics, is what Aristotle said. And how you do that is with this storyline. And that's why stories are important. Now, not just action are derived by this prism of this internal story, but also perception itself. Perception itself. What you see is your story, literally. There is this amazing illusion that's on YouTube. You can all go look it up. It's called Monkey Business Illusion. Very popular. So what happens in that video is there are three people in two teams. One team is wearing white, the other is black. And they have two basketballs with them. And they're passing the ball to their own team. right? You are asked to count the number of times the white team passed the ball, right? So you go through the video, you watch 1, 2, 3, 4, you count, right? At the end of the video, they'll say, what is your count? You say something, they'll say, okay, the correct count is 16. And then they'll say, did you notice a gorilla that walked by? And half the people wouldn't have noticed a large 800-pound gorilla walking past, pumping its chest and walking away. Because the story you're told, that in which you're operating, is, I want to count the number of passes the white team made. Your perception has eliminated everything else, including an 800-pound gorilla. And then they ask, even the half people, half of the population who saw the gorilla, they ask, did you notice that the color of the curtains changed in between? Almost nobody notices that. And then, did you notice that one of the members of the black team just left halfway through? Almost nobody would have noticed it. It's that the amount of sensory input we get is infinite. It's extremely large. You cannot focus on every single one of them. You have to privilege certain input above others and focus on it. And how do you do it? You do it through a story. So in this case, when you're counting the number of passes made by the white team, that's the immediate paragraph of the story. It is in a larger story, which is, I want to understand how perceptions work. Why do you want to understand how perceptions work? Because I am in search of truth. Why are you in search of truth? Because my search of truth helps me comport with reality better. Whatever it is, it's nested in bigger and bigger arcs of your storyline. So what we have seen so far is, we tell ourselves stories. Stories are nested, and they are in the societally nested overarching structure. The same stories can yield multiple values according to the cultural milieu in which they are told. They're individually consequential, as we saw with Brothers Karamazov. They influence our actions and our perceptions. So it is vitally important. So then, now almost halfway through or more, we'll ask the most important question. What story should we consider? What story should we tell ourselves? So let's look through a few stories and their consequences in history. Let's look at, we cannot look at individual stories because it's called qualia. There's no way to look into somebody's story and live it. It's that first person experience that one has is impossible to convey. This was captured very well by one of the philosophers who wrote a book called What It Feels Like to Be a Bat. A bat, you can never know. You have to be a bat to know how it feels like to be a bat. So you won't know this internal first-person experience. So we won't be considering individual stories. It can be also very fanciful, but we'll consider more historical arcs. We'll consider the storylines and their effects that they've had. And some of them are very stark. There are lots of twists and turns. Let's take the interesting story of Islam. So after the 7th century, right, Islam conquered most of the known world, right? Like all of the Greeks, Romans, Greco-Roman, Byzantine, all of these people we talked about were basically vanquished and conquered. And it was a golden age of Islam. They came to possess all of the rich heritage of Greco-Roman culture, which they translated into Arabic, and they studied, and it was a golden period. In fact, it was Islam that took the Greco-Roman culture, preserved it, and handed it off to Europe, which was in dark ages back then, and they then took it. But something changed in that arc for Islam. And if you look at the history, there's a very interesting twist in that story. So this happened sometime in the 12th century, with a thinker whose name is Al-Ghazali. He lives in Baghdad. He looks at what's happening in this Islamic milieu around him, and he makes a very interesting. He develops a very interesting storyline. He says, these philosophers that you guys are studying are incoherent. His book is called Incoherence of the Philosophers. He says, there is no natural law. There is no human law. There is no law other than the law in this book, which is the Quran. And all other laws, all other causality that you find is because of the immanence of God. Immanence with an A, meaning inherent nature of God. And he famously said that when you take a piece of cotton next to a flame, it catches fire in every single instance because God willed it. That's why you find most people in the Muslim world saying, inshallah, God willing. It's Al-Ghazali's twist in the storyline that there is no other law but the law of God, and his will moves even a blade of grass. I think we also hear this many times in some of the Hindu kind of narrations as well. What was the consequence of that? What ended up happening was, they said, if there is no other law, then what is the use of studying these philosophers? If there is no natural law, why should we follow scientific enquiry at all? We have to study this one book, and that will explain every other law. So there was a rejection of human laws. So there was no kind of rule of law was kind of abrogated in deference to Sharia. There was rejection of science, rationality, rational inquiry, and basically more theological study, which we find even today, a lot of Islamic countries are in the doldrum of that storyline. Let's find another twist in the story. Let's take another interesting Abrahamic religion, Christianity. Interestingly, Christianity was in its dark ages then, right? Church had overrun rational inquiry. Galileo, who said, hey, you know what, actually heliocentric theory makes sense, was shown the instruments of torture and said, do you really think the sun is at the center? And he said, okay, no, you're right, the earth is at the center. You know, it was in the thick of the dark ages. And that's when, right in the middle, there was this guy, Thomas Aquinas, who came in and gave a little twist to the Christian story, right? Thomas Aquinas is very well regarded, but his twist was as follows. He said, there is eternal law, but that eternal law, he was basically borrowing Plato here, natural law partakes of that eternal law in some measure, but not fully. So you have to study natural law. Gravity is a natural law. You take cotton next to a fire, it burns. That's natural law. God has nothing to do with it. It partakes of the eternal law in some way, in some small measure. And to the extent that it partakes in it, it is beautiful. This is exactly Plato in a way, right? With his Platonic world of ideal forms and the forms here taking part in them. And he said there is divine law, which for him was revelation and the Bible. He had that also. He didn't let go of that. And human law also. And he chose this one episode from Jesus's life to hold to human law, which is, you know, tax collectors come to Jesus and, you know, the people ask him, do you want to pay taxes? And says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And he says, human law, respect human law as well. So he divided that into eternal law, natural law, divine, and human laws. And what did we see? We see because there is respect for natural law, there is rational inquiry. You know, most of Europe pulled itself through rational inquiry and through enlightenment out of the dark ages. We saw the respect for human law, so there is rule of law, there is, everything we get with English common law and Magna Carta came out of some of that. So there's a twist in that story. So all you have to do is just tweak that story a little bit and you see that the trajectory of the civilization changes. Now, we are now at the final stage of the story where there is now rank materialism everywhere we see. That's the storyline. This has led to a crisis in meaning everywhere, right? So now there is again a dire need to retell the story. Which story will you tell? Right? This is the question. Now, let's quickly, maybe running out of time, but consider the idea that when you choose a story, you are basically letting go of every other story. There's only one story that you can choose. So you choose that wisely. The river of life, as it were, takes every false narrative and dashes it against rocks of reality and shatters it, right? If you have a false narrative that is not permanent, that is not comporting with reality, life has a way of showing you that you have a wrong story through reality checks. Again, we cannot consider individual reality checks, but let's take two from the recent past. Taking the storyline from 9/11, the reaction from America was to say, you know, we appreciate our enlightenment values, we appreciate our democracy and liberty, everybody's like us, everybody around the world wanted, we should go give them democracy. After trillions of dollars and millions of bombs and hundreds of thousands of lives lost, we have the same Taliban in power and ISIS in Iraq. So it was a rude awakening. The story that they were telling themselves was not true. The same happens at an individual level. Whatever story you have, the realities of life has a way of correcting it, shattering it if it is not true, if it doesn't comport with reality. So what is the story that comports with reality? Here we come at last, in the couple of minutes remaining, to the theosophical story. What is the theosophical story, right? The theosophical story is that you are a fallen angel. It neither has the original sin, it neither has the materialistic, you are from dust and to dust you shall return. It neither has these imminence of God and heaven and hell, but rather you as a fallen angel. Now, what does that mean? You come from a high estate. In your innermost reality, in your innermost essence, from a very high estate. And this here, you're caught in the webs of delusion and in the thraldom of senses and their sense objects. Why has that happened to you? Because of the necessity of evolution and perfection. You are here to garner experiences, like the bee goes to every flower, garners the most ethereal portion of that flower, its nectar, and is unconcerned with the vicissitudes of that flower and goes on to the next. You, in your true essence, are immortal and of a high estate. You're only here as a bee on this flower to collect its very spiritual efflorescence. And you collect many of these, and in that journey are approaching towards perfection. Okay? Then are you the flower? Are you the bee? Well, you are both, because in the ultimate analysis, these two, the vehicle and that which inheres in the vehicle, are two aspects of the one whole. What does that mean? It means that each of these rays from this one absolute, which differentiate to become various monads, are in various stages of evolution. You can think of it as a ladder of being. Those at the lower end of the ladder of being sacrifice themselves to provide vehicles so that those in the higher aspects, so higher parts of the ladder, can garner experiences through the vehicle. So in a way, those elementals, as we call them, sacrifice themselves to provide you opportunities for evolution, because it's only through this playground that we're able to garner experiences and evolve. So they, in a way, take care of our kaya kshema, kshema of our body. We, in turn, are then responsible for their yoga kshema, for their spiritual evolution. So we have reciprocal responsibilities for those below. Similarly, there are those above us, and they have in their compassion, in their responsibility to those lower than us, which is us, provided us with what is true, what is real. And this storyline of who you are is that material. This comports with reality. It says that you're not some boat in some river which will get dashed against a few rocks and be shattered at some point in time. You are the river itself. So you flow like the Tao. You flow around these obstacles and you reach that ultimate goal, which is the ocean from which that river sprang. That is the storyline. That storyline is eternal. It is based on the realities of where we exist. And that storyline is a theosophical storyline, which, if we can tell ourselves, will have both a grand vision and purpose for yourself and responsibility for all the other particles in this river that are flowing, that are part of yourself. So hope and responsibility. That is the storyline that theosophy offers. That is the storyline we believe can be salutary in this moment where we are in a crisis of meaning. With that, we'll end and open it up for discussions and questions.